This is the second year that Dr. John Marciano has led a popular study group considering Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Dr. Marciano is Emeritus Professor, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. In 2004, he began the series at the now-departed Midnight Special Bookstore in Santa Monica. The series now continues at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. Every month, this group meets to discuss the assigned reading, individual chapters in people's history. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. This recording by the LA Sound Posse was done on August 16th of 2005. It contains John's commentary, titled Wars and Empire, considering chapters 8, 12, and 14 of People's History. A discussion session follows the talk.
Okay, we're going to talk about war and empire, wars and empire. I was listening to KPFK coming down Lincoln. They were discussing the National Guard units that are from California that are in Iraq and Afghanistan. I didn't realize how many. Roughly 12,000 National Guard troops in California, 9,000 of them are in Afghanistan and Iraq. They were discussing this with someone from Code Pink, who's saying if it puts Californians at risk, if there are natural disasters, civil disorders, God forbid there should ever be civil disorders in California. As you know, the LA Times ran long stories on the 40th anniversary of the Watts Uprising here in Los Angeles. So 3/4 of National Guard troops that are California, and I'm sure it's heavy in many other states. So the American Empire is alive and well. The three wars in these chapters are merely particular aspects of the permanent, or what we might call a permanent or endless war that has marked the United States since 1776. The U.S. has been at war constantly since 1776. The argument is that empire is as American as apple pie. If we fail to see this, we will oppose particular wars without understanding how they fit into the overall physics of state violence. As writer Randolph Bourne, who's quoted in Zinn, stated about Woodrow Wilson's war to end all wars in 1917, quote, war is the health of the state. According to the authors of Afflicted Powers, it's a very provocative book I just finished, the three wars under discussion, as the present ones in Afghanistan and Iraq, are part of an almost unbroken line of imperial American military intervention. They are part of a state of permanent war, of a long and consistent pattern of military expansionism in the service of empire. The authors establish a template of American imperial expansion, against which in turn to view the ongoing wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. They argue that regardless of the tactical details of various invasions, occupations, and retreats, the U.S. empire has followed a long and consistent strategic path centered on and driven by military engagement. Throughout this history, what passes for peace has been part of an endless series of wars. They caution those of us who oppose the present wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I quote, unless the anti-war movement comes to recognize the full dynamics of U.S. militarism, to understand that peace under current arrangements is no more than war by other means, then massive mobilizations at the approach of full-dress military campaigns must inevitably be followed by demoralization and bewilderment. Just think back 2 years, millions of people in the streets, and then the war begins. In a sense, doesn't begin, it continues. Call that the war against Iraq has been going on since January 1991, and there was no let up even through the Clinton years. In fact, because of the economic sanctions, more people, mostly children, died in Iraq under Bill Clinton's 8 years of presidency than the total loss in the two wars under the Bushes. Many of us forget that. They make a desert and call it peace. The great quote by the first century Roman writer Tacitus still drives to the heart of the matter, according to these authors. States are deeply war machines, and the peace that they make is the peace of pacification. Always they are in search of better ways to make a desert. Now, with those as sort of prefatory comments, let's look a little more specifically at what Zinn raises in these chapters, beginning with Polk's rush for the U.S.-Mexican War, and of course, as an example of manifest destiny. It's interesting that even someone as establishment a figure as former President John Adams called James Polk, a later president, an Anglo-Saxon slaveholding exterminator of Indians. Nice comment. We recall, of course, that Congressman Abraham Lincoln opposed the war against Mexico, but as so many other people who oppose wars in the U.S. Congress, did not vote to stop the money. Anti-war sentiments today and during the war against Mexico or during the war in Vietnam, I would argue, mean absolutely nothing unless the funding is ended. Only a very few anti-slavery congressmen voted against all war measures during the Mexican War. Many believed, of course, in the United States that the war was for democracy and racial superiority. And of course, we were a slave society, and Texas would end up as a slave state, which of course can't be reconciled with democracy. But since Americans felt they were following God's designs and used religious ideas to justify the war of aggression, in which the Anglo-Saxon race was destined to govern the inferior Mexicans, that huge contradiction sort of slipped past. Abolitionists protested the war, opposed the war, arguing that it was waged slowly for the horrible purpose of extending and perpetuating slavery throughout Mexico. But as with all wars, not just in the U.S., it had to be given a patriotic God on our side to appeal to the masses. Zinn tells us, of course, the abolitionist and writer Henry David Thoreau bitterly opposed the conflict. You may know, of course, they released a Thoreau stamp a few years ago. Since he's been dead a long time, he's not around to bother us with his writings and commitment and principles. He argued at that time, who can be serene in a country where both the rulers and the ruled are without principle? My thoughts are murder to the state and involuntarily go plotting against her. As for the U.S. government, Thoreau felt that he could not, without disgrace, be associated with it. William Lloyd Garrison, another abolitionist, argued that this was a war of aggression, of invasion, of conquest. The great abolitionist Frederick Douglass called it a disgraceful, cruel, and iniquitous conflict. Zinn tells us that the writer John O'Sullivan coined the term manifest destiny in July 1845. Those who supported this concept saw Latinos in general and Mexicans in particular as culturally inferior and lacking in democratic institutions. This was Mexico, which had abolished slavery. They were lacking in democratic institutions. This was at a time that the U.S. still had a slave society that would not end without the massive conflict of the Civil War. The print media of the time were filled with all sorts of articles promoting the superiority of white Europeans over Indians, blacks, and Mexicans. Sound familiar? The war produced horrifying brutality and racism, so much so that it was even condemned by General Ulysses S. Grant, who was later U.S. president, who called it one of the most unjust ever waged by a stronger against a weaker nation. In his Harvest of Empire, the author Juan Gonzalez discussed the relentless incursions of Anglo settlers into Latin American territory. Led by the traders and merchants, Presidents Jefferson, Jackson, and later Teddy Roosevelt, among others, regarded U.S. domination of this entire hemisphere as ordained by nature. The main proponents and beneficiaries of this empire building were speculators, plantation owners, banks, and merchants who bankrolled armed rebellions in the Spanish-speaking lands by white settlers. But of course, one of the problems that emerged is as these lands are conquered, came unwanted people who didn't look like Euro-Americans. Native Americans who were pushed farther west and then herded onto reservations, and several million Latinos who were placed under U.S. control. The Mexicans of the southwest of this region of now the United States became a foreign minority in the land of their birth, relegated to a lower class status alongside of Indians and blacks. U.S. imperial expansion from the 19th century continued, of course, into the 20th, as American-owned plantations spread into Mexico, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, Honduras, and Guatemala, and over the time, millions of peasants would be forced from their lands. Puerto Ricans ended up as U.S. citizens in 1917 when Congress, in its beneficence, passed an act making them U.S. citizens, despite the unanimous protests of the House of Delegates in Puerto Rico. We're going to make you U.S. citizens, whether you want to be U.S. citizens or not. So much for Woodrow Wilson's self-determination, which never meant to apply to people of color throughout the world. When Wilson was talking about democracy, he didn't mean people like Ho Chi Minh, who in 1919 at the Versailles Conference tried to see Wilson and say, well, how about helping us get the French out of Vietnam? He couldn't even get to see him. The Spanish-American War, as we know it, as we learned it in school, was actually part of the Cuban War for Independence. Zinn argues that like all wars, this one was not the result of some instinctive force within humans, but was organized and encouraged by the press, military, government, and eager to please intellectuals. Oh, we could talk day after day about eager to please intellectuals in our American universities who have, for the most part, despite the myths that so many of them are anti-war, are always around to support any U.S. aggression abroad. So think of later times in terms of this war, the Cuban War for Independence. Later, take the same ideology and apply it to Vietnam, Grenada, Panama, Iraq, or now the war on terror. A number of scholars, including Zinn, as he points out, argue that the underlying cause was political and economic, was the need for foreign markets for our surplus products. Based on the firm conviction that domestic well-being rests on sustained, ever-increasing economic expansion, U.S. expansion abroad has been used to resolve internal economic contradictions and clashes by providing an outlet or empire for exploitation and development. Wars are essentially fought over political and economic causes. They are fought over resources, but they need to be explained in ethnic and religious terms, often to hide the true issue, which is control by a small group of people over the resources and vast peoples across the globe. I would argue that Vietnam, Iraq, any war that you want to look at, especially beginning with the real push for U.S. empire in the late 19th century with Teddy Roosevelt. The U.S., of course, gained colonies from the Spanish-American War, including the Philippines, which led to a powerful rebellion and U.S. terror that would be matched and repeated 60 years ago in Vietnam. If you read the history of U.S. aggression in the Philippines, the search and destroy missions, the incredible racism, the horrors, I mean, countless My Lais, the similarities between the war against the Filipinos and the war in Vietnam are amazingly striking, especially the atrocities and the racial hostility. The Filipinos were the early 20th century version of the Vietnamese GOOP. And I remember meeting some people with the Vietnam curriculum group in Boston that worked with the Indochina Bulletin. And this is 20 years ago. We're working on about a 100-page curriculum on the Philippines War, and it absolutely was striking. Page after page, if you just changed Philippines to Vietnam, it was the same. It was the same. The ideologies, the comments by troops against the Filipinos, though some of that was contradicted, especially by the black troops who were sent to the Philippines and who saw what was happening and in terms of how they were being treated, as did many African American and Latino troops in Vietnam. Now, lest people think that the accusation of empire and aggression is a little too harsh, even at that time, the influential Senator Henry Cabot Lodge boasted, quote, "We have a record of conquest, colonization, and expansion unequaled by any people in the 19th century. We are not to be curbed now." Okay. When those in the heart of the group that's really doing the aggressing make these comments, you have to listen. This is a truth that we have been blocked from seeing and from hearing. This is the real history, not the fairy tale that we were taught in schools about helping. I remember textbooks back in the late 50s in high school about helping our little brown brothers in Latin America and elsewhere. We're always helping everywhere. That's the traditional view we learned, just as the traditional view also taught us that the U.S. was essentially isolationist, especially leading up to the First World War, until world power was thrust on us. We didn't want to do anything, but somebody had to take up the responsibility of running the world. So that at the end of the 19th century, you have all these things being thrust on the U.S., Cuba, the Philippines, etc. And that essentially the United States, that is the common version, is that the U.S. has been anti-imperialist, anti-empire since the founding. I would argue that you cannot read any objective history of the United States beginning in 1776 with actions against American Indians. And I mentioned this before, for example, in upstate New York, where I used to live, in Ithaca, New York, home of the Cayuga Nation, in which General Sullivan in 1779, on direct orders from General George Washington, burned and destroyed most of the Cayuga Nation villages, their crops, their orchards, because they had been sympathetic to the British during part of the Revolutionary War. So the picture we get is not what actually happened. But it didn't matter because Euro-Americans assumed a posture of moral and ideological superiority from the beginning. So the major story that we got was that they/we were superior and believed that America had been handpicked by God to lead Anglo-Saxons in transforming the world. At least some of us from Southern and Eastern Europe understood we were not part of the Anglo-Saxon. We didn't know a lot in high school, but the high school I went to, we knew we weren't Anglo-Saxons, that's for sure. This view was especially strong at the time of the war for Cuban independence. This view continues, as do the internal contradictions of capitalism and the struggle for resources that formed the basis of World War I. Woodrow Wilson addressed the issue of economic surplus at home and the economic contradictions. Quote, "Our industries have expanded to such a point that they will burst their jackets if they cannot find a free outlet to the markets of the world. Our domestic markets no longer suffice. We need foreign markets." Thus, when Wilson stated that the world must be made safe for democracy, he really meant it must be made safe for capitalism. It had nothing to do with democracy, with freedom, or equality. Wilson, who was a pretty pompous, self-righteous guy, Southerner, racist to the core, viewed himself and the U.S. as trustees of the world's welfare. The destiny of America was to be the justest, most progressive, most honorable, and most enlightened nation in the world. Wish it were true. Any truthful analysis of Wilson's claim, however, would reveal just the opposite regarding the official policies, tragically supported by many, many people, average people in the country, beginning with American Indians, a history that is not progressive, not honorable, or enlightened. An example of Wilson helping to make the world safe for democracy and his support of self-determination came in 1916 when he sent U.S. troops into the Dominican Republic, dissolved its legislature, imposed martial law and press censorship, and jailed opponents. The occupation lasted 8 years. It was one of the many, many U.S. incursions, invasions, aggressions throughout Central America and the Caribbean. It prompted widespread protests against the U.S. throughout South and Central America, created deep bitterness in the Dominican Republic, and radically altered every sphere of Dominican society. It would be played out again in May 1965 when Lyndon Johnson sent the Marines in to block the election of a candidate not favored by the United States. It's a month or so after the U.S. really started to escalate the Vietnam War and send troops. Especially under Wilson, Central America and the Caribbean became extensions of U.S. dominance that have continued to the present in Guatemala, Cuba, El Salvador, Nicaragua, especially Cuba from 1960 on, El Salvador, Nicaragua in the 70s and 80s, Guatemala, of course, their government overthrown in 1954, leading to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, and who knows how many refugees, many of whom have settled in the Los Angeles area. Zinn tells us about the massive propaganda that was used during World War I, supported by Wilson, led by the Committee on Public Information, and its major effort, of course, was to control public opinion as a major force during the war to get Americans to support that war. There was a tremendous amount of anti-war sentiment in the United States leading up to the war. And in fact, we must recall that Wilson was elected as a peace candidate in 1916. He kept us out of war. And it's interesting that three of the major wars in which the U.S. has been involved, three major architects, Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson, all elected as peace candidates, Wilson in 1916, Roosevelt in 1940, and 1964, I remember it was the first election I could vote, Lyndon Johnson was not going to send any American boys to do what Asian boys could do, and the Democrats painted Barry Goldwater into a total lunatic who wanted to drop bombs and involve the U.S. in the war in Vietnam. Little did we know, of course, that the U.S. had been engaged in secret missions against North Vietnam and had been deeply involved in that theater of war for some time. We later found out. So propaganda was absolutely critical then, as it is now. Citizens had to be convinced that the war was not Wilson's conflict or sort of instigated by a small group of people in terms of their interests, but it was the interest of all. That's the national security argument. It is never in Bush's interest or the Democrats' interest or the ruling class's interest or the administration's interest. It's in our interest. It's in the free world's interest. It's in humanity's interest. It's never in the interest of a particular group that has to articulate its interest as the interest of all, because too many people would get the clue unless this veneer was not put on the war. The war for democracy abroad, of course, as Zinn tells us, under Wilson at home, resulted in suppression. Under his leadership, Congress passed the Espionage Act of 1917 and the Sedition Act of 1918. What was labeled as disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the American government or any words likely to bring it into contempt, scorn, or disrespect, including remarks questioning the war or the wisdom of its leaders, were outlawed. Offenders were subject to deportation or prison. It's important, especially now with the war on terror and the things happening in the U.S., that people not have historical amnesia. The attack on the anti-war movement, on the left, on progressives, and on dissenters just around the time of the First World War, and especially after the war with the Palmer raids, were far more serious than we are now facing and far more serious than happened during the Vietnam War. All this was necessary to crush the powerful anti-war feelings that blocked the call for war. The war was supposed by the left and many working people. And as Zinn points out, great gains were made by socialists in the 1917 local and state elections. But they were crushed by government repression. Even socialist leader and presidential candidate Eugene Debs was imprisoned for a speech against the war. War was used to destroy the radical industrial workers of the World Union, and its end brought increasing attacks on radicals and the beginning of anti-communism in the United States, which included an invasion of the then newly formed Soviet Union, a fact that most Americans do not know. Many of us simply do not know that the United States, along with France and England, invaded the Soviet Union right after World War I, 1918. The attacks, of course, in the U.S. culminated in the Palmer raids, one of the early, it may have been his debut, working under Palmer, of that great American J. Edgar Hoover, who started his illustrious career. The arrest and deportation of thousands of people, a Red Scare far worse than anything that happened, by the way, after World War II during the McCarthy period. Sort of misnamed, because the McCarthy period actually started years before with the loyalty programs under Harry S. Truman, long before tail gunner Joe McCarthy got up in 1950, I guess, in West Virginia, and he had a list of, I have a list of 146, 25. The list kept changing by the minute. So attacks on progressive, leftists, the ACLU, liberal Democrats. This happened in the time of World War I, and it happened again after World War II, before McCarthy. Zinn tells us also that aside from a few dissenters, schools and universities supported the war in keeping with their essential role, which is really, despite the wonderful, courageous work, always of a minority of teachers, and I use teachers in a generic sense, regardless of the age group that they're teaching, the essential role of institutions of education in this society, in any society, is really to foster uncritical support of government policies, not to turn out people like Howard Zinn. And that was their essential role, even at the peak of the anti-war protests in the United States, which peaked, many argue, in May 1970, with the killings at Kent State and then Jackson State on May 4th and May 15th, 1970. Even at that time, most of the teachers, most of the university professors in the country were not anti-war. They were not against the war. They were against the way the war was being fought. And by then, it was clear the U.S. was not going to win that war. Though I, more and more, have come around to the position of Noam Chomsky that the U.S., in many ways, did win that war, because it absolutely crushed the Vietnamese hopes for any kind of a decent society in terms of the massive civilian losses, the ecological damage, the economic strangulation after the war. So Woodrow Wilson, often thought of as a liberal icon, which he was. You study the history of the progressive era, there were a number of quote-unquote progressive things that happened. I remember from my undergraduate history days, we learned about Wilson. Wilson was a progressive. The progressives did all these wonderful things. He was also a very convincing, very committed, and principled imperialist crusader. Wilson, in fact, Bush has talked about Woodrow Wilson, and when you read some of the neocons, they will argue over and over again that, in a sense, Bush is Wilsonian, and that he's pursuing Wilsonian policies. I would argue they're right. It's sober to reflect that for decades, Wilson's name has been invoked to sanctify virtually every military action that an American president has chosen to pursue, including the current war in Iraq and Afghanistan. However, if we take history seriously and we look at Wilson's actual record, as I said, especially close to home in Central America and the Caribbean, which got the blessings of the U.S. Marines, thanks to him, as well as a little invasion of Mexico, we see that Wilson had no intention of spreading democracy, and that Wilsonian idealism was simply a pretext for cynical empire and imperialism that uses virtuous precepts as a moral cover for endless war and expansion. One must ask, how could a government that committed genocide against the nation's original Americans and aggression against smaller and weaker nations decade after decade possibly export democratic ideals anywhere? You can't export something you do not have at home. And remember what was going on. W.E.B. Du Bois was writing about war, even though Du Bois, and he later regretted it, he ended up supporting at first World War I. But Du Bois and others, particularly in the African-American community, absolutely went after the Wilsonian ideals. And when you know what was happening in the United States, especially against people of color, okay, the 19-teens and the 1920s in the United States, a period of terror against people of color, especially in the South, how does that society get off thinking it's going to go anywhere else and tell people about democracy? There was no democracy in Washington, D.C., which was a segregated city, profoundly so. Now, the argument, in a sense, taking off from Zinn, I would argue that the U.S. government has been able to get away with this monstrous lie because of the help of a bankrupt educational system, the mass media apologists, and they're out there now, as you know, they all fell into line, all of them, when the war finally broke out, when the war commenced in March 2003, they all supported the first Persian Gulf War. They all supported the sanctions. So the mass media, the educational system, and religious institutions, for the most part, are always ready to bless the wars. So Wilsonian policies were not a doctrine of democracy or internationalism, in the best sense of those two terms. They fostered the view of American exceptionalism. We are the city on the hill, expanded, though, to global dimensions. We are anointed by God, we as in the United States of America, worthy and wonderful, and therefore suited by providence to go forth in the world, spreading democracy and freedom wherever we go, like Johnny Appleseed. And when you listen carefully to Bush's speeches, it's a rehearsal, it's an echo. It's, as Yogi Berra said years ago, it's deja vu all over again. The same pronouncements. We are good, we are the kindest, gentlest people, and we're therefore going to make everybody else kind and gentle, even if we have to absolutely make their country a desert. So you go back and you read Wilson's speeches and other presidents, and you read Bush, and you see that Bush is not an exception. The neocons have not hijacked the U.S. government. Continuity is the principle here, not exception. What is happening, it may be a little more upfront, it may be more aggressive than Bubba Clinton did, etc., but also go back and see what happened in the former Yugoslavia, but it is not a discontinuity with U.S. history. Continuity is the principle here. I leave you with two comments that challenge the premises of the U.S. empire. The first, during the debate, I'm going to forget the senator's name, during the debate over the annexation of Hawaii. I mean, who knew when growing up, you know, Hawaii became a state? Who had any idea how we ended up with Hawaii? Well, then you read about it and you find out. The Hawaiians were not thrilled about being taken over by the U.S. Many of them still aren't. One senator said, "Manifest Destiny has committed more crimes, done more to oppress and wrong the inhabitants of the world than any other tribute. It has caused the strong to rob the weak and has reduced the weak to slavery. Manifest Destiny is simply the cry of the strong in justification of their plunder of the weak." Now, what senator is going to get up in the U.S. Congress in 2005, even as eloquent as some of the speeches Robert Byrd has made? Eloquent speeches, but the last vote, by the way, for the $82+ billion for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, the vote in the U.S. Senate was 99-0. I don't know where the other person, there are 100 people in the Senate, so someone evidently wasn't there. Byrd, Kennedy, Kerry, Biden, Dodd, every liberal, every senator, Clinton, my former New York State Senator, Schumer, everyone, oh, liberals all, by the way, though not a single one of them would ever use that word, okay? They are on the liberal end of the spectrum, so they can make all the speeches they want, but no one is going to get up and say what this senator did about 100 years ago. The second quote I leave you with in closing came in 1935 when former General Smedley D. Butler, twice decorated with the Medal of Honor, Marine General. There's a great little booklet they've put out. It's called War is a Racket. He discussed his role as an agent for the U.S. Empire. It took him a while to come around to this and look back, the luxury of hindsight, giving a lie to the myths that we were taught about American ideals. And who knew? I mean, this guy says this in 1935. We go through schools, never heard of this guy, never heard of this quote till even past graduate school. Here's Smedley. "I spent 33 years in the Marines. I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for Wall Street and the bankers. I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests in 1914. That's when Wilson was president, by the way. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys. I helped in the raping of a half dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for Brown Brothers and Company. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for the sugar interests in 1916. That's when Wilson sent the Marines in. I helped make Honduras right for American fruit companies in 1903. This was and remains the truth about U.S. policy, not the myths that we were taught in our school textbooks and classrooms about democracy and freedom. That's how they connect to the Mexican War, to the Cuban War, and to World War I. Again, as I said about the senator, there's some generals who've actually had some grumbling in the Pentagon about this war. Can you, again, imagine in your wildest dream, nightmare, ever hearing a general state this today? My thing was, I actually wrote a little piece, I'll leave you with this. I wrote a little piece that is going to be published in my former hometown newspaper, and actually was published last week in the Santa Monica Mirror, about Hillary Clinton. Can anyone, when you think of what some senators have said about wars in the past, can anyone ever imagine Hillary Clinton, who may be the Democratic candidate for president in 2008, saying what that senator said about Manifest Destiny, or, God forbid, saying anything along the lines of Smedley D. Butler? Not in your wildest dreams. It'll never happen. So, let's take a break. Okay, let's open it up.
Just a quick question. When you said that the way the lie is supported is through a bankrupt educational system, the mass media, and religious institutions, would you talk to what happens to these people who at times seem almost progressive and then they're just cowed? They just are lockstep, like that vote that you said 99-0. It's astounding. Could you talk to that?
Yeah, the Senate vote was 99. Oh, well, why don't you share that comment first?
Okay. I think it might have been an A.B. Goodman or Democracy Now. Someone, a guest speaker, was on there, and he said that it doesn't matter whether you're Republican, Democrat, conservative, or liberal, they all vote the same way when it comes to this particular issue, because every single congressperson never asked the question, is this money going to do us any good? Do we need to spend this money on the war rather than for health issues, social issues, our infrastructure? Congressmen never ask that question. The question they always ask when it comes to a vote like this is, how much money is going to go to my district? That's what they're concerned about, nothing else.
Right. I was going to say that the House vote, I think, was something like 382, the last spending bill, funding bill for the war. Senate was 99, zip. The House was something like 382 to 47, 46, and that included Bernie Sanders, the one independent. Three Republicans. One of them was Ron Paul, this conservative libertarian ex-physician from Texas, who voted against the war on terror and, as I recall, the authorization, the resolution on the war, because he's got this odd idea that the Constitution says something, Congress shall declare war. I don't know. He must be out there in West Texas, too, maybe. But many, many, in terms of the numbers of people and the numbers and the amount of money going to various congressional districts in the country, that does become a very powerful reminder to people, that people are working in the defense industry. But yet, you know, there are people who vote against the appropriation. And it's the appropriation that's the key. As I said, you can vote all the resolutions you want. You can make all the speeches you want. You want to stop the war? You stop the money. You will cause a constitutional crisis. But Congress appropriates the money in the Constitution. It's absolutely clear. If you read the Founding Fathers, there's no thing that they were clearer on than the idea of making sure the executive does not make war. It must be in the hands of the people's representatives. And you read Madison, you read Hamilton, you read the proceedings of the Constitutional Convention. And yet, since December 8, 1941, there has been no declaration of war since that time, and the United States has been involved, who knows how many wars, you know? They've been all over the place. So they got to stop the money. If the people say, I'm against the war, and they have the ability to shut off the funding, the spigot, that's what they need to do. We'll get back to your...
Yeah, I think that a lot of the folks come across as progressives, and they end up voting for the war. I don't think they really ever really grasp really what's been going on a lot of times with the world. And they start looking at their self-interest, they start looking at the path of the least resistance, and they start becoming more and more conservative-minded, more and more empire-supportive in a lot of ways. A lot of them, even people who were quote-unquote progressives at one time in their youth, attended sessions like this, attended anti-war demonstrations and what have you, They never really grasp what the country and what the whole society has really been constructed as. And they see a question of good people, bad people type of thing, and they don't really see that it's a systematic process that takes place, that these people fit in and out any which way they come. And until people actually start grasping that, I don't think they ever will seriously stay true to anti-war activity, to progressive causes and things of that nature.
Well, the money going to the arms industries, there are arms industries. In fact, this was done, I think, purposely. There are nuclear industries and arms industries in nearly every state of the Union, so that every state has an interest in getting all of that money for arms, for their jobs, you know. I always thought that Harry Truman was the one who started this war, you know. Okay, we're going to have a war economy from now on, because we don't want another depression. That happened right after the Second World War. He met with the Dulles brothers and some of the CEOs and some of the big shots in those days, and they decided they don't want another depression, and the war kept them from having a depression. So they decided, well, let's just have a war economy. But apparently, it's much deeper than that. Apparently, it goes way beyond that. It's been happening all the time.
Well, but, I mean, let's say there was a qualitative leap forward after World War II and the development of what we now know as the national security state, when 1947, the National Security Act, did some things with the various armed services, created our friends in Langley, Virginia, the Central Intelligence Agency, changed the U.S. War Department to the Defense Department. I mean, that was a stroke of brilliance. I mean, the person who came up with that, bureaucrat or civil servant, should have been given retirement with, you know, a home in Florida or whatever. I mean, I think it's just the change. We're not in the War Department business. You know, Rumsfeld is Secretary of Defense. McNamara was Secretary of Defense. Many people argue that's when you really have the deepening of the permanent war economy. And as the end of World War I, because there was tremendous resistance to a permanent war economy in the United States, and remember, you have almost 12 million men and women in uniform coming back home from overseas, having many of them seen absolute horrors, there was a tremendous left in the country, the labor movement was much stronger. As with the end of World War I, there had to be a very concerted effort to break the back of dissidents in this country to move forward with a permanent war economy. And it started under Truman. And one of the people, conservative Dwight Eisenhower, one of the people who actually tried to rein in the Pentagon and cut military spending. And they did it by trying to cut back on troops and just having more nuclear weapons and planes. And if you think back to the election of 1960, Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon, Nixon running for president, were baited by John Kennedy as really selling in the United States against the Soviet Union, which had caught up to us and was passing us, and there was a missile gap and a bomber gap. Was total crap. It was absolute lies. Kennedy knew it. He had been briefed by people about that. So it has deepened every single year, so that a huge proportion of our actual federal budget goes to war, past war, veterans benefits, interest on the war, the black budget, CIA, NSA, etc.
Thanks, Sean. So I appreciate being here and hearing the history according to Howard Zinn, and adding the drama back into the history. And most of the time, I just want to hit my head on the concrete here, but I, now having listened to George Lakoff talking about the narrative, and now Robert Reich talking about the narrative, because at base, we always think of ourselves as good people. You know, that's what we always want to believe about ourselves, and that makes us susceptible to propaganda. I grew up the same as you a little bit later, and so for me, it was a revelation when I saw Little Big Man, which I knew was a fiction movie, but to see the kind of the story told from the point of view of the American Indian. But of course, the American Indian, Chief Dan George, is saying, we're the human beings. And I think any group of humans on the planet always think, we're the humans, and the other people, I don't know what they're doing. And so that appeal always has great effectiveness. I was wondering, when you mentioned that, because I've also gone up to upstate New York and been crushed by the history of the Indians, but just to add a little to the drama, I think, and you could answer better than I can, I imagine that the Cayuga Indians were part of the French Indian War. I mean, I know we call it the French Indian War, but the French had organized some of the American Indians to fight the British.
Right.
And I imagine that the Cayuga Indians found themselves, they didn't understand these macro politics going on, but when suddenly these same Americans, George Washington had fought against the French Indian Alliance, and that they couldn't figure out when it comes to our revolution, that George Washington suddenly wants the American Indians, and as if he's going to support their interest, that they wouldn't put everything they could against him. You know, just for me, it adds to the tragedy of the American Indians in the Northeast that they were caught up in these politics that they couldn't possibly, and these wavering alliances. So when you say George Washington ordered a guy to go in there, that's not so different. Apparently, Herman Melville's grandfather attacked at Fort Stanwix, the Pequot Indians. Oh, yeah. And so Herman Melville wrote about it in Moby Dick, in a way, which is sort of his challenge against manifest destiny when he has the Americans go out, or the American whaling ship go out on the Pequot, and it's this ship of state managed by this mad Ahab with this monomaniac intention. But he critiqued his grandfather, who had fought at Fort Stanwix outside of Albany. But there's an element of history that just, I'm not trying to make it more baffling, but there's a dramatic dynamic to it that finally ends up with those with power tell the history because they've survived, and we don't hear the history of the losers, and that would add a great deal. But at the end of the day, these people, whether it's Truman, Truman was a minor congressman from the South who was put on the ticket with FDR, who was kept in the dark about the Manhattan Project and God knows what, at the treaty at Yalta. He'd know none of those things. Right. When Franklin Roosevelt had his stroke and died, and suddenly this man is elevated to the most powerful position. At the end of the day, I mean, they were very arbitrary, and I wish he'd done better, but I do find myself wondering about these people that are put in the position of president. There's only so much they can do. It's the art of the possible. And it revolves around the general public having a much better idea of what in the world's going on. I do wonder about the Cayuga Indians. You just kind of presented it as if there was no history before the American Revolution.
Right. Of course, there was a history, and forget how some of the different nations within the Iroquois Confederacy split. Some were more supportive of the American side we call it a revolutionary war. It might have been a war of national liberation. And you're right, we have to keep individuals in the context of their times. No matter what Truman or Roosevelt or Wilson or Kennedy or any president, in terms of the structure that we live in this society, their options, as powerful as they are limited. And you're right. Harry Truman, as Vice President of the United States, knew nothing about the Manhattan Project until he was told after Roosevelt died. I mean, think about this. You were the second most powerful person probably in the world. This project was going on underneath the University of Chicago, and also research, as I've discovered in finishing a book on the Cold War, also on my former campus, the University of Rochester, where they were doing research in radiation. And one of the people doing that research went to Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the war. So there's a structure and a history. And he was not free to do anything he wanted to do and made decisions within that structure. And of course was made the choice to be vice president by Southern Democrats to ease out Henry Wallace, who was clearly far to the left of Truman. And a number of people argue, well, if Wallace had been vice president, he would have been president after Roosevelt died, and maybe the whole history of the Cold War would have been different. We got to think about that. Structure has a way, you don't end up being president of the United States. I mean, Howard Zinn, there wouldn't have been a snowball's chance in hell of him ending up as president of the United States, not with these views. One quick thing about so many of these things, all of these things to a point, I didn't learn anything about them. And I had some pretty good teachers, and a number of you have heard this, and I was a history major at the University of Rochester. I read a lot of history, of all sorts of things about U.S. history and Indian history in New York State, and then later the history vis-a-vis Guatemala and Cuba. Didn't have the foggiest idea. And I grew up in a pretty progressive household where especially my father was talking about these things, grew up reading The Nation, etc. All of us were sold a bill of goods and weren't able to think critically about these issues because people weren't there to help us. I mean, that's what teachers do. That's what adults do. So therefore, I can't think critically about the Cayuga or Harry Truman or the Cold War or Woodrow Wilson if I'm not given that help. And that's the educational system, of course, ideally is there through teachers to help young people develop the critical tools of inquiry, to ask fundamental why questions. Well, they haven't been asked. They're still not being asked by most people who are in the classrooms, whether they be graduate, you know, graduate professors at UCLA or kindergarten teachers. And that's because of their training, etc. But 40 years ago plus, when I was in high school, this wasn't around. There were other things around, but I didn't know about it. So there's certainly far more young people and people our age who have been exposed to things like this today than 40 years ago. And that's where the hope comes from.
I wanted to get back to why Congress votes for war, you know, why in the November before this Iraq war started, the congressional vote. You know, Wellstone had just been assassinated. I believe he was assassinated. And sometime before that, Mel Carnahan also was assassinated by plane crash. And I heard from various people that Congress was scared to death. That's what I heard. The people in Washington were scared to death around the time of the vote on the Iraq war. I wondered if you knew anything about that or could corroborate. How true was that?
The vote, you're talking now, the vote for the resolution to give the president authority to
yes.
do whatever he needed
yes.
to do. We'll leave because there's a whole other issue. There's a powerful assertion you made that Paul Wellstone was assassinated, and I think that's an issue that would need to be examined in terms of where the evidence is,
sure.
et cetera. I would profoundly disagree. I think he died in a plane crash. He just simply wasn't powerful enough for anybody to want to assassinate, but that's another issue.
What about Mel Carnahan?
Or Mel Carnahan. Mm-hmm. Now, the vote, as I recall, we're talking about November 2002. The vote in the Senate, I believe, was 77 to 23. So there actually were 23, and I think they were all Democrats. Forget, I think at that time, what was the split? 50 to 49. It was pretty close, the Democrat-Republican. So I think almost close to half of the Democrats in the Senate voted against the resolution. And the vote in the House, I think maybe 120. I'd have to go back and check, but certainly far more than just voted against the funding. So there were people, as frightened as they may have been, who voted against the resolution. And they were overwhelmingly almost all Democrats. They didn't come from, not to put down people from Wyoming or Montana, but that isn't where they came from. They weren't people from Kansas and Nebraska. They were, you know, representing those of us lunatics on the left coast and east coast, etc. Urban areas, I believe the vote in the House in the Black and Latino caucus was something like 48-8. Overwhelmingly, representatives, Latino and Black caucus voted against this war, the resolution. Okay, remember, it was a resolution. It was not a declaration of war as mandated by the Constitution. And then it was quite similar to remember, there was a great deal of discussion prior to the first Persian Gulf War, when I think the vote in the Senate was something like 57-43, and in the House, sizable number. I mean, it may have been 150. Not that it was going to stop George Bush the First. If you remember, at the time of the vote, there were 300,000-500,000 troops were already in place, regardless of any declaration. So even under conditions of real fear, maybe the Patriot Act would be a better example. I mean, that went through 98-1, Russell Feingold voting against it. Or the War on Terror would be probably the best example of the argument about fear. Barbara Lee being the only person in Congress, the only person. And that was, what, November, October 2001, shortly after 9/11. You want to talk about courage, standing up, voting against that a month after the terrorist attack. So, I mean, it's fear, but at the same point, and this is maybe why I'm being critical of the liberals, the Democrats, many of the people who run now, especially in the House of Representatives, run either uncontested or have no danger of losing their seat. Overwhelmingly, there's no real contest for most of the districts in the House of Representatives. The incumbents, it's up to 90% or something. It's, you know, they get the money, whether they're progressive, whether they're conservative. And increasingly, that's happening in the Senate as well. So why these things happen, I mean, I don't know. I think my attitude over the years has been the more power, the more flexibility you have, the more secure you are financially and in your job, those are the people that I have the most problems with. I mean, people who would lose their jobs in 2 hours if they spoke out against the war or raised an issue at Walmart and they got a pink slip the next moment, I can understand them clamming up. Tenured professors at UCLA or the State University of New York, who no one's going to bother them if they speak out against the war on terror or the war, I absolutely have no patience with them whatsoever. If they're against the war, they need to say it, they need to write it, they need to do something. They have a lot of luxury. Nobody's going around like 1919 firing U.S. professors, okay? Very few have gotten into trouble, War Churchill being one of them, and I don't know how that's transpired because that's just dropped off. But there's been no mass firing of people at UCLA or Berkeley or where I used to teach because of speaking against the war. So what stops people? I'm not sure. I mean, that's part of the question that you asked.
Hey, John. Earlier you were talking about Wilson and him coming from the South. I just was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit, because I'm familiar with a story about him having some economic interest or some participation in the making of the film A Birth of a Nation. And I also believe that it was during his presidency that the largest demonstration of the Klan took place in Washington, D.C. That was around 1918, 1919. So I was just wondering if you could give a little bit more background on that and if you know anything about his affiliation with D.W. Griffith and Birth of a Nation.
I know that they had a screening of Birth of a Nation at the White House. I didn't know whether he had any connection.
He was one of three principal individuals who were involved in making that.
Wow. That I didn't know.
Yeah, and I know he was governor of New Jersey before he...
originally a Virginian.
Okay, Virginia.
Very strict, I forget whether he was Calvinist, Presbyterian, whatever. Was a professor also at Princeton. We won't hold that against him, you know. I didn't know about Birth of a Nation. The Klan was extremely strong in that period, not just in the South, but also, again, going back to upstate New York. The KKK was a group of people. They were just in Mississippi, Alabama, and a few states in the South. They really peaked in the 20s, though. Supposedly around 5 million people, a number of senators, congressmen were involved with the Klan. Their attacks, of course, were primarily directed against black people in the South, but they added Catholics and Jews. Think of the period around the Scopes trial in Tennessee, which was, 1925, maybe, 24? And yeah, the Klan, I mean, they used to have marches in upstate New York and in Jersey and all over. And Wilson, as many other presidents, Republican and Democrat, remember, residing in Washington, D.C., a southern city, a segregated city, did nothing in terms of speaking out. As, by the way, Franklin Roosevelt, who was pressured over and over, including by Eleanor Roosevelt, to really speak out and support a federal anti-lynching law, did not do it for fear of losing support, because remember, the Southern Democrats, who had been getting elected again and again and again because they terrorized all the opposition and blacks who couldn't vote, they dominated all the committees in the Congress all the way through Roosevelt's time and Truman and even Eisenhower and then Johnson. Lyndon Johnson had to sit down and jawbone with Southern senators that he knew, because he was senator from Texas, in order to get civil rights legislation through, and a number of them voted against it.
When it comes to Lyndon Johnson, one thing I've got to say in favor of him, and not in favor of Franklin Roosevelt, is you said Roosevelt had the fear of losing the entire South. But the moment Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Bill, he told everybody in the room, ladies and gentlemen, with this signature, the Democrats have just lost the entire South.
Right. And he was right. He was right. In fact, I think, 5 or 6 states in the South, and maybe his own state, and Goldwater, that they attribute to the real beginning, or maybe reemergence, of the right, the religious right in the United States with the Goldwater election. And actually, there's a fine book, I forget what it's called, about the rise of that after Goldwater's defeat, starting in Orange County, south of us. I'm blanking at the name of it's a marvelous history. I mean, you know, a few people getting together in their living rooms and so devastated. I mean, Johnson won, he won 45 states, he won electorally. I mean, he won overwhelming. Absolutely overwhelming. Everybody said the Republicans are dead. The conservatives are dead. It was the liberal high water in terms of elections. And you remember what happened, Ilva. You know, some really positive things came through, all as a result of the struggles of the civil rights movement. Johnson was pushed, and other people were pushed. Strom Thurmond is still, of course, well, he was in the Senate for, what, 300 years? He filibustered. But Johnson, yeah, that quote, I mean, he was right. And then you begin to have the Southern strategy with Nixon using code terms to appeal to whites in the South, states' rights, etc. Whites who had voted Democrat, including for Roosevelt and Johnson, begin to shift in 64 dramatically, in 68, 72. And then it's full-blown when the great, whatever they call him, Reagan became president in 1980.
Hi. You mentioned the funding for the war, and if you dry up the funding, there's no war. This Cindy Sheehan thing, there's one aspect of the Cindy Sheehan thing that really excites me because it's getting so much media, and she has already stated that she's not going to pay her taxes for 2004, and she said, she made a challenge. She said, you come and get me for it, and I'll put this war on trial. And to me, that is the most awesome thing she could have said because she's putting it in the bank. She's banking against the war.
Yeah, it is the money. Having done some tax resistance during the Vietnam War, and it was a drop in the bucket. But with no money for the bombs, the guns, the missiles, the things grind to a halt. And thinking of, because it was right across the parking lot here this last March when Cindy Sheehan and Bill Mitchell and some of the Iraq Veterans Against the War were here and listening to her. I mean, I can't imagine the courage of standing up after you lose a loved one like that. But just the idea of a single mother doing this, could you imagine a movement, especially of mothers, far more than fathers, not that we are irrelevant in this, but mothers, which has not happened, by the way, in U.S. history, not even during the Vietnam War, of mothers blocking the ability of the government to take their sons and daughter. I mean, I don't know whether a mother is going to be able to ground a 21-year-old guy who wants to go in the Marines. You know, get back to your room. It may not work. But you have thousands and thousands and beyond mothers, not just here, but everywhere in the world, to stop the ability, because in addition to the money, they don't get the bodies of young men and women, especially men, to go over and kill people they don't even know. I mean, what's Bush going to do? He's going to go himself. He's going to, you know, get in his flak jacket and go in a plane and do. It would be over. It would be over. You have to have the bodies and the equipment. You deny the empire that. It's gone.
It yeah, John, gone. I have a son. I have a son and a daughter. I also have a son. And when this Iraq thing was happening, some people didn't know me very well because they looked at me and they said, aren't you worried about Jordan? And I said, no, because I won't let him go. I'd rather go to jail and he won't go. I would let my son go? Never.
Good. Carol?
This is kind of a non sequitur, but going back to talking about the pattern of deception that the various administrations have foisted on the American public in wartime, there was an excellent article in the LA Times about 10 days ago on Hiroshima and the propaganda that the American government used to convince people that we should go drop the bomb there. I know Zinn also touches on it in one of the chapters in the book, but many historians now agree with Zinn, and there's a great deal of documentary evidence to support the idea that we never should have dropped the bomb, that Japan was very close to surrendering. There was really no justification to drop it. And the figure which was pulled out of the air that maybe 500,000 Americans would die if we didn't drop the bombs was totally unrealistic, but it also made me think of racism, that American governments consider American lives more valuable than those of other countries, and it was better to kill several hundred thousand Japanese than 50,000 or 10,000 Americans or whatever figure they came up with.
That was a good article by Kai Bird and Martin Sherwin, I think, who have a chapter in a book when they had the Enola Gay controversy a few years ago at the Smithsonian. A group of historians, they put together, I think they were the editors of a book by a number of historians, and I'm not sure if Garl Perowitz had one of the articles. He wrote the book, The Decision to Drop the Atomic Bomb, which is, I would argue, the seminal work. I mean, because he really got a hold of the documents, and I don't think anything's been done. And, you know, we know now that from MacArthur to Eisenhower to Admiral Leahy to the U.S. bombing survey after the war, in which people met, that included generals, all sorts of people from the military, saying very clearly that it was not necessary. And Truman, they just picked this 1 million troops, then it was 500,000. Of course, there's no doubt, given what happened on Okinawa, that had the U.S. invaded Japan, that there would have been tremendous casualties. That's never been in doubt. But they're also not in doubt is that the Japanese were ready to surrender. And something I didn't know till just a few days ago, reading one of these articles, that on the day of the actual surrender, which I think was August 15th, 14th or 15th, 1945, the United States sent 1,000 bombers to Japan and absolutely devastated. I think it was 64 cities, killed hundreds of thousands of people. The war was over. This is after 5 days or 4 days after Nagasaki. This is after two atomic bombs. So, I mean, one might argue, Truman and those who support him, that the U.S. had to drop the atomic bombs. But imagine after that, when it's clear they're just waiting for an hour or 20 minutes for the official signing, you send 1,000 U.S. planes. And there was no air defense, by the way. The Japanese had no air force, nothing. It was a slaughter, as it was in Dresden and some of the German cities.
I read somewhere that the U.S. wanted to keep Russia out of Japan.
Exactly. They dropped the bombs the day before Russia would have entered the war, and we wouldn't have had Japanese surrendering some of their territory.
I don't know. In fact, I think it was, I believe it was General LeMay. I think it was Curtis LeMay, who, of course, later came to fame again when he wanted to bomb, quote unquote, North Vietnam back to the Stone Age, because the war was over. The war was over. I forget, maybe it was in the article I just read, that there's a, not that it has a life of its own, but almost as it does have, the military machine has to be used. There's so many people invested, millions of people, including when you think of generals and senators who have to get contracts. Think of the whole history of this state. You think you'd have 35 million people living in California if it weren't for the fact that the taxpayers of the country helped the boom in California, Texas, Arizona, Nevada, and Florida, all the southern rim states in which millions of people went? They're going to go just for the weather if there are no jobs? This is a military-industrial state par excellence. Lockheed and North American, Douglas Aircraft not far from here, where they made all the C-47s during World War II, and evidently kept, as I found out, the Aero Theater open 24 hours a day so people could get off of their shifts at midnight and go to the movies. Well, that's, I mean, you know, who's against that? But it's almost as if you got to use this stuff. We got it all around. Missiles and bombs and planes and more planes. And even the mayor of Nagasaki or Hiroshima said, you know, if the U.S. is concerned about nuclear weapons, just last week, in fact, he said, what are you doing having, I think we still have probably about 10 to 20,000 nuclear warheads, which is enough to blow up everyone in the world probably 100 times. It's insane. So.
Okay, I have a quick one then. Given the current power structure in the U.S., then does it matter who gets elected in 2008?
Yes and no. That is, domestically, I mean, we were talking over here about Hillary Clinton, who everyone figured that Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic Party's candidate in 2008. And we were sharing all naturally, collectively, our pearls of wisdom about Hillary right over here. It remained off. We were off tape and off camera, though. And I was saying that, let's say that happens, that in terms of some domestic issues, there's no doubt that Hillary Clinton would clearly be more progressive than the Republican candidate. Keeping in mind, I articulated in a letter, paper about Hillary, that the whole debate in the country has moved so far to the right that the Democrats are off the shoulder of the road, hugging the conservatives. On a number of issues, there is a difference. But on the national security issue, on imperialism, on the empire, in many ways, there are no Democrats, there are no Republicans, they are only Americans. They are Americans first, they are red, white, and blue, and as you and I were talking before, if the U.S. decides to engage in aggression against Iran, which they're already floating, the trial balloons, the president, they'll float it, see what happens. Okay, lots of people's minds are on Cindy Sheehan, the war in Iraq, Iran, well, North Korea. Not a single prominent Democrat that I know of has opened his or her mouth about the idea that going in and bombing a country is against international law, it's against the U.S. Constitution, which is irrelevant, by the way. On those issues, Hillary Clinton, female though she may be, will be like Thatcher or someone else, that she will send U.S. forces to devastate a country and make Iran a desert. If she does not, they will impeach her. Here we're dealing with the real core of the system. We are the empire. Even though the empire is crumbling economically, the empire cannot even control two devastated poor countries like Afghanistan and Iraq. But she will do it. And the Democrats, Kerry would have done it. And, Wilson did it. Truman did it. Johnson did it. Those of you who've been lifelong Democrats, and I started at that place too, if people decide to support her against someone else, at least do it with eyes open. And I don't even know what her position is going to be on choice for women by 2008. She's now wants to reach out to those people of faith who are against abortion, and she's been doing the waltz with Newt Gingrich. I mean, he can't even dance.
For the future, how long do you think this empire, this military industrial complex will last before we burn ourselves out?
No one here has a crystal ball. I mean, economically, if we were a small country, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund would have called in the chips already. We owe trillions of dollars. We're the greatest debtor country in the world. Foreigners last week alone picked up $71, $75 billion in bonds and T-notes. I think one thing we can learn by looking back is, and this may seem outrageous, unlike the Soviet Empire, which at the end went down without taking all of Eastern Europe with it, and the Soviet Union. Gorbachev, they could have called out the Red Army and there would have been a bloodbath in East Germany after the wall went down. There would have been, some bloodbath in the former Soviet Union. They did not do that. This group, particularly now with this sort of messianic, we are the world, I got close line to Jesus, it'd be like the Samson complex. I think these guys will take down the world rather than lose their power. So the question is, how much time do people have to disarm the most violent, obsessive, fanatical people on the planet, the people who run our country? And some of them, sadly, are Democrats. I say that out of terror. You know, I've lived most of my life, and I mean, with kids, with grandkids, the stakes are huge.
If we don't change the policy, we are going to burn ourselves out.
Well, we're going to burn ourselves out. We're going to destroy. We are destroying the planet, but mainly the victims are the people of color and poorer people here in the U.S., disproportionately women. The victims are Guatemalans, Salvadorans, Afghanis, Iraqis. Pick any place in the world. The victims are not post-World War II Japanese, Germans, Europeans, Australians, Canadians. It's the North versus the South. And unless history is going to dramatically change, I mean, no empire has gone down with a total whimper. It's never happened. Not in the West. Not the Brits. Took World War II. Not the French. Okay, Indochina and Algeria. Spanish, the Portuguese, the Dutch, etc., etc. None of them went down. It took resistance. I'd still be having to think of the Brits as wonderful. I mean, God, that would be really terrible. You can have the final word. It's time to go home.
Okay, I'm sorry there's not time to answer this question, but I want to float it.
Yeah, leave us with some things to think about.
Paul Harvey leaked about a month ago in the right-wing radio something about a nuclear solution to this problem in the Middle East. And he's using the kind of rhetoric that we're familiar with from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, such as making an example, being more efficient, and saving lives. And that's kind of a little test balloon because Harvey has a lot of credibility in certain circles.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm wondering if, I've talked to some of my friends and colleagues in the anti-war movement, which we're all part of, I'm sure. And when I mentioned this, that some of the momentum that the anti-war movement has gained may be from what John referred to in this presentation today as not so much being against the war, but being against the way this war is being waged. And they may, in fact, be right-wing elements. that may be pushing for this kind of quote-unquote solution. And so I'm sorry that there's not time to discuss it, because this would be an ideal place to hear some of that discussion, because it's so frightening a prospect. As we're all taking heart in what's going on with Cindy Sheehan, monsters like Rove and his ilk are planning stuff like this in the wings. And we need to consider that as we look at this as maybe hopeful. You have to give it a more nuanced look as well.
No, but profound thoughts that, as I said, if we don't think beyond, you got to think Iraq and Afghanistan and beyond, because otherwise every single war, we're going to be reinventing the wheel and not being able to connect the dots. And history helps you connect the dots. Iraq is Vietnam, is Panama, is Grenada, is Algeria, et cetera, in terms of the West. And it's to her credit, of course, she was against this war before her son went over and before he died, and she's raising profound questions. Many others need to, because I think a lot of the people that you talk about are not going to raise their voices. The U.S. goes in and does the ultimate solution against the people of Iran or North Korea, and the people in this government will use those weapons. They will. They have no moral qualms. They will only be stopped by greater force in the world and by political power at home. They have no moral qualms about killing people. You had an announcement.
Thank you. On a more hopeful note, it's so profoundly disturbing, and I don't mean to transmit that, because if we don't have hope, we don't have anything. This summer, I went to Cuba on a delegation with the Venceremos Brigade. It was the second visit there, which challenges the travel ban. And we were, last time I think we were 80 people, this time we were 50 some odd, and we were doing it in concert with some other groups, including Pastors for Peace. And that is certainly a reason to take heart and to take hope, to see a society that is planned and working, and it's wonderful. And if you are interested in participating in that, or interested in hearing any more about it, I feel very enthusiastic, because we have this living model. I had the privilege with this group of in the Karl Marx Auditorium in Havana, which seats about 5,000 people. We were one of the groups invited. And this group, that the Venceremos, has been going for 35 years. So they're known. And Pastors for Peace is also very well known. And there are some other. There's a women's group, and there's a labor coalition, and there's some other groups that we were working with as well in terms of challenging the travel ban. And we all were attending speeches of Alarcón. But to hear Castro in this little auditorium was truly breathtaking. And one of the things that he did was, at the very end, link the fate of Cuba and place Cuba historically with Venezuela. And if you're ever interested in the speech of Chavez that he gave at the, in fact, it was on the KPFK this morning on the 7 o'clock hour. I'm sure it's on the net someplace, but it's really inspiring as well. So if you're interested in ever participating in something like that, or hearing a little bit more about it in detail, you can get a hold of me through John. My name's Mary Rushfield, and please shoot me an email, and I'm happy to answer, because it's a real source of hope, and so different than what we're experiencing here.
Okay, thank you. Have a good month. I'll see you next month.
You have been listening to Dr. John Marciano's presentation of Wars and Empire, commentary and discussion of chapters 8, 12, and 14 of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. The group met on August 16th of 2005. Every month, this group meets to discuss the assigned reading, individual chapters in People's History. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.